morning. We have three cases left on our March calendar, and the council have been advised that we're expecting a school to come, and they will be ushered in. So you hear the rattling behind you. That's our Salem High School. The first case is 11AP 394 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Demon Alexander. Representing Mr. Alexander is Attorney Hans P. Kesser. Is it Kesser or Kaser?
Kesser.
And representing the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Thomas J. Balistrieri. Mr. Kesser, you may proceed.
Yes, good morning. As indicated, I do represent Mr. Alexander. I think the starting point here is whether Mr. Alexander has both the statutory and constitutional right to be present at all proceedings when the jury is being selected. Now, clearly, I think State versus Harris is a case that states that he clearly does. But I'd like to discuss both the statutory and the constitutional aspects. First of all, Section 970.104.1c of the Wisconsin statute says that a defendant shall be present during voir dire of the trial jury. Okay, now the key word I think here is trial jury. Okay, normally a trial doesn't begin until after the jurors have been sworn in. And, in fact, jeopardy doesn't attach until a jury has been sworn in, and I think the state has conceded that. So when you use the term trial jury, I think it clearly refers to the jury that's already been sworn in and jurors that have already been that have already heard some testimony and have sat in during the trial, listened to the evidence, et cetera. In its brief, the state refers to the dictionary definition of voir dire as the preliminary examination of the jurors. And I would agree that voir dire normally does refer to this initial selection, but not always. I've certainly been in trials where perhaps some issue will come up with the jury. Say, for example, maybe the jurors will see a defendant in shackles. And the judge will say, well, we'll have to voir dire the jury on this issue. So I think that that term isn't clear.
Well, it used to read, a defendant has a right to be present at all proceedings when the jury is being selected.
Right.
That was the original language. Would that be of greater help to you today than the present language?
I think not necessarily. I do see this judicial council note from 1996.
Right.
And I did read through that. But I think what we have to do is deal with the statute that's in place today.
Well, it was a court rule. It's in the statute books, but this was a court rule.
Okay.
And the judicial council note says, the prior statute's reference, which is what I just read, to all proceedings when the jury is being selected, was probably intended to include only those at which the jurors themselves were present, not the selection of names from lists, which occurs at several stages before the defendant is charged or the trial jury picked. Because then the literal when the jury is being selected would start out maybe in sending out a jury questionnaire.
Right.
You obviously didn't intend that, so it limited it, but I thought you would rely on the judicial council note, include only those proceedings at which the jurors themselves were present. Were the jurors present here?
Correct. I would agree with that, and I think the way it's been modified, it could be interpreted as such, that the phrase is presently used in the statute means that the voir dire of the jury, whether that occurs before the jury is selected or after the jury is selected, but does not include, say, the initial process by summoning jurors and trying to select them. So I would agree that maybe the statute has been made better in that respect. I think the question is, though, whether or not we should narrowly define voir dire as applying only to the initial selection of jurors. And I think just the literal reading of the statute suggests that we should not. During the voir dire of the trial jury, I think if they intended to mean the initial voir dire, it would have been worded differently. I think it would have been worded something to the effect of that the defendant shall be present during the initial voir dire of prospective jurors.
Counselor, does it make any difference, or should it make any difference in our decision, that Mr. Alexander's attorney spoke with him about the questions the judge put to the jurors?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is that his personal right to be present is a personal, non-waivable constitutional right, or at least his attorney can't waive it for him. I think the case law and the statutes are pretty clear on that. It's a personal, not only statutory, but constitutional right that he possesses, and that if there's to be a waiver of that right, the trial court's required to engage him in a colloquy to determine that his waiver of that right is being done knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently.
So you don't think that the attorney's presence and then a subsequent conversation back and forth with his client is sufficient to be the equivalent of his personal presence? Is that
absolutely
what you're saying?
Not.
Okay.
In fact, I could envision a situation where a criminal defense attorney might have a client that just looks guilty right from the outset and says, you know, I'd rather not have him here at all. So I'm going to make a tactical, strategic decision to waive his presence, ask the judge, judge, just leave him down in the jail, and we'll try him in absentia. So later on, that defendant comes into, on appeal, argues that his right to be personally present has been violated. And then the response from the state is, well, you're going to have to prove that. I mean, there was a trial. You can't show your attorney would have called any different witnesses. You can't show that his cross-examination would have been any different if you'd been sitting there. You would have just been a potted plant in the courtroom. And your attorney would have cross-examined the witnesses the same way, would have called the same witnesses, would have made the same objections to the state's arguments. So you can't prove that your presence would have changed the outcome of the proceeding. That'll be the next case if this court decides in favor of the state.
Well, this is an issue in this case. Your brief and the Attorney General's brief take different positions as to who has the burden of proof. You take the position that the state had the has the benefit of the error, whatever that is, the alleged error. It has the burden of proof to show no harm. State takes the position, this is ineffective assistance of counsel, if I understand the state, and they can correct me, that the burden of proof is on you to show, one, there was error, and two, that it was prejudicial. So it seems to me if burden of proof matters, isn't that an issue this court has to decide?
Yes, it is. And I think that this court has already decided in Anderson, State versus Anderson, that the defendant may directly challenge this issue and that he doesn't have to do it via ineffective assistance of counsel. And in fact, from the beginning of this case, at least from the time I filed the post-conviction motion, I didn't frame this issue as an ineffective assistance of counsel case. And in fact, if I tried to argue that today, I think Mr. Ballester would be well within his right to say, to object and say, you didn't raise that issue. No, we didn't. And that's why the second and third arguments of his brief, I'm not going to discuss in too much detail. What I wanted to make clear, though, is that this is a direct challenge, and the burden is on the state to prove If they want to try to overcome this, they have to, let me make sure I get the language correctly. They have to prove, is it proof beyond a, let me find that, proof beyond a reasonable doubt that that the error wasn't harmless, and that's what I believe the burden is here today.
Counsel, you indicated in response to the Chief Justice's question that since post-conviction time, you have not framed this case as ineffective assistance of counsel.
At least this issue.
Well, the Court of Appeals, in paragraphs 21 to 30 of its opinion, treats your argument, as I understand it, as ineffective assistance of counsel.
If the court would give counsel one moment to review those paragraphs. Paragraphs 23 and 24.
21 to 30, and it is right before 21 is Roman numeral number 2, ineffective assistance of counsel. The first sentence in paragraph 21. Alexander also argues that his trial counsel was ineffective. And now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's just with regard to some specific issue that we don't have here today. So help me with that, if you will.
That was actually a separate issue that really I'm not raising here on this appeal. In the Court of Appeals, I raised several other issues, including one, ineffective assistance of counsel, of trial counsel, because it had shown, and that it was shown, at least I thought it had shown, and obviously the Court of Appeals disagreed with me, but there the issue was whether or not trial counsel was ineffective for turning over some of its work product to the state when it had no duty to do so, and then the state used that work product of the public defender's investigator to basically destroy the defendant's only alibi witness.
Okay, so with regard to the issue that we have here today involving the voir dire,
right,
you have neither in the Court of Appeals nor in this court advanced an argument of ineffective assistance of counsel. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And that's what it says on page 3 of the Court of Appeals decision, and it's they treat it as a direct question on appeal as to whether a trial counsel can forego on behalf of the defendant, the right to be present when a juror is being questioned. I think this was in chambers, wasn't it?
Yes, that was, as I understand it, I didn't do the trial, I just did the appeal.
The other question I have to, just to get back to what happened at trial, one of the jurors, there was a question right at the very beginning in the voir dire, if I remember. Is that right, or did it happen after voir dire?
What was the question?
Well, were both jurors challenged or came to be questioned after they were seated?
Yes, they were seated, sitting jurors.
How many were seated in this trial?
You know, I'm not certain. I don't believe they had to call an additional, so they must have had at least two extras.
That was my thought, too. They had two extras. And then a question arose about a juror during the trial, and the court said, let him sit. We'll deal with it later.
I do recall that, yes.
Okay. And then for another juror, when the question came up, can't remember whether the judge said, I'm going to rule right now, or at the end he ruled on both jurors. But the question came up after they were seated with alternates being there, too.
Apparently. That's correct. And, in fact, they were sat through the entire trial and listened to all the evidence. And the issues concerning the two jurors, off the top of my head, I'm sorry, I can't think exactly where they came up, but it came up during the trial, maybe towards the end of the trial. The issues came up with regard to both jurors, and I believe the trial court said, well, we'll just deal with this later. There may have been some discussion of it prior to the end of the evidence, but ultimately then it was the in-chambers discussion where Mr. Alexander was excluded came after all the evidence had been submitted. That's what my recollection is.
That's mine. And one of the reasons that he seems to be interested in the striking of these jurors is that they were two African-American, the only two African-American, but he's not making a Batson claim.
That's correct. I'm not arguing Batson here today, and I think I made that pretty clear in my brief. I only mention it in my brief because, of course, I do have a client that I have to answer to, and these are the things that concern him. So I felt that I should at least just mention that, although I'm not relying on that as a basis for reversal, and I'm not arguing a Batson violation. But my client is African-American, and I think any of us could imagine if we were in his shoes. Say one of us were on trial in South Africa, and there was a juror of basically white person, we're white, obviously. There was a juror of 14 people. There's a white judge, there's two white jurors, and the rest of them are African Americans, and now suddenly there's these proceedings that are held outside of your presence, behind your back, and suddenly you're brought back into the courtroom and you're told that, yeah, the judge just got rid of the only two white jurors on your jury. You'd feel a little bit, I think, suspicious too, or worried about that, and that's how my client felt. It's not an issue on this appeal. I'm not arguing a Batson violation here.
Could I ask, yes, sir, I've got a couple of questions I'd like to ask you. When you started out your argument this morning, you started talking about State versus Harris and indicating that you felt that was a controlling case. Isn't that a very different situation? My understanding is the defendant's in prison. The judge decides he's going to have some initial screening of 50 jurors. And so he does that initial screening while the defendant is in prison. And this is prior to the trial. It's not something that occurs during the trial. Isn't that a very different situation than what we have here today?
Right, but my reliance upon Harris is primarily for the legal principles and not to argue that the Harris is factually indistinguishable from this case and that because there was this result in Harris, we should do that here too. I'm relying on Harris primarily for the general legal principle, and I think which was affirmed in Anderson that, not necessarily affirmed, but repeated in Anderson that a defendant has a personal constitutional right to be present, which cannot be waived by counsel. So that's why I relied on Harris, more for the general principle, not because the facts were such that we can use it as guidance in this case.
Well, let me ask you another question. As the Chief Justice was asking you earlier, you've got 14 jurors seated in this case. Well, this is a case that went on for, I think, about a week. So it would be very usual for a circuit judge to seat more than the 12 jurors. In other words, to have a couple of alternates. You don't generally designate who's going to be an alternate until you get to the end of the trial. And isn't there some discretion in the circuit judge as to how the alternates are designated so that he ends up or she ends up with a jury of 12? The judge waited here until the very end, and he decided that since there were questions involving these two jurors, these two jurors were going to be designated as the alternates. Isn't there discretion in how the court designates the alternates?
That's an interesting question, and I'm not certain I quite have the answer to that. I do know that as a matter of practice, at least the trial courts in Kenosha County, where I'm from, have a little box, and they put the names, it's like a spinning wheel for the lottery, and they put the names of the jurors in the box, and they give it about 10 turns, and then they reach in and pull out the slips, and then the person is relieved of further responsibility. In some cases, usually I think they only pick, most courts will have one additional juror, In this case, there was two, obviously, probably because of the length of the trial. But that's how it's normally done. The question is from the court as well, if there is a situation where the trial court has the 14 at the end of the trial but has some doubts about one or two of the jurors, can the trial court in its discretion then decide that, well, I think that these two people ought to be the ones that should be kicked off for various reasons? Well, then you might wind up in situations like we had here where the trial judge, of course, the trial judge was black, but, let's get rid of these two black people here, you know. So, and although maybe that's not what he's thinking, but actually I would feel uncomfortable with the trial court having discretion at the end of the trial to make a decision. Well, I looked at this whole jury and, those two jurors, I just didn't like them for some reason. I didn't like the way they looked. So I think I'm going to kick them off. No, I think it should just be done by the lottery system.
I thought the trial court here actually found that they should be dismissed for cause, at least one of them.
That's true.
But maybe I'm wrong. I thought as to the second one, the trial court said, I'm removing you for cause. But I could be wrong about the facts, but that might change it. Then the question is, was there justification for cause if there's an objection now? So was there justification for removal as cause?
Not in my opinion, no. And in fact, I deal with that in my brief. Basically, one of the jurors that was kicked off apparently knew one of the witnesses because there was like a motorcycle group that hung over at somebody's house, and he recognized that person as being a guy who used to come over to that residence as part of the motorcycle group, but he didn't really know him at all. So that would, and so that, I don't think that's reason enough to strike a juror for cause.
That was juror 10. Go ahead.
Yes. That's not, and in fact, that juror, as with the other juror, said that I can be fair and impartial, and he vowed that he could be. I can decide this case fairly and impartially. He's kicked off anyway. And the same with, I guess, maybe the case would be stronger with regard to the other one. I believe it was the case that that juror had recognized a woman in the back of the courtroom because the woman in the back of the courtroom was the sister of a friend of hers. Turned out the woman in the back of the courtroom was the mother of Mr. Alexander's child, although the juror didn't know that, and Mr. Alexander certainly didn't know her. But she, too, indicated that she could be fair and impartial, and I think the connection there between was just too attenuated. So my argument would be that at least in terms of the facts of the case, that a showing hadn't been made that she should have been stricken for cause. That's
Counselor, wasn't she concerned, though, that the lady in the gallery in the back had had a falling out with her sister, the juror's sister, and they just still had some continuing difficulties, and I thought she made some statement about she was concerned that that woman somehow would retaliate against her while she sat on the jury. Wasn't that part of what was going on in this case?
Yes, I believe that was said. Sometimes people just make statements without really thinking things through. I don't know. I'll concede that point that she did make that statement. I do recall that. But I think the big picture is here that in and of itself wasn't enough to, I think, show that the juror was or couldn't reach an impartial verdict in that case. And, in fact, that juror said she could. So I think that that isolated statement that she made, I think, was insufficient to disqualify her for cause.
You know, here the defendant was apparently outside of chambers. Right?
Yes, as far as I know.
I mean, that's what it appears like. So the judge says to defense counsel, your client is waiving his presence. Defense counsel says yes. The judge has questioning of the jurors, and in each juror, the judge says to defense counsel, go talk to your client. Right?
That's right.
Defense counsel goes out, apparently, talks to the client. We don't know what was said, right?
That's
right. Comes back and says, my client does not object to this juror and wants to keep this juror, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not just a waiver of, you know, the lawyer saying, oh, he's sitting in the cell, he doesn't care about this, or I'm making the tactical decisions here. The defendant is participating by being outside. Now, maybe your argument has to be that's not full enough participation.
Right, but then on appeal, how are we supposed to know if all that information was communicated to the defendant, all the important information? We don't know what the substance of those discussions were. And I think that...
Do you need a Machna hearing about ineffective assistance of counsel, then?
Right. And that I suppose that would be one of the ways of remedying it if the defendant then alleged that, well, it's true that my attorney was coming back during this proceeding that was occurring in chambers and coming back and consulting with me. But, you know, I just really couldn't get the full flavor of what was going on in that room. And I was really concerned about it. And my lawyer didn't really tell me very much at all. And I don't feel that I really had a good grasp of what was going on in chambers there where the judge was getting rid of two jurors that already had been selected during the initial voir dire. So the fact that the lawyer was going back and communicating with her client, I think is just not sufficient. I think it's much safer to have a rule where the defendant has to be present during proceedings of this nature. And in fact, one of the cases here, it talks, is it the Lehman case? Talks that these sorts of situations occur all the time. Let me just see if I can find that.
We can find it quickly. Okay. You have time in rebuttal, counsel.
Here we go. And I don't want to just read from the view. I don't know if the court has my brief up there, but, and I don't want to
read.
Okay, page 9 of my brief.
Okay.
There's a block quote.
This is from Lehman.
You can just review that block. Such inquiry generally should be made out of the presence of the jurors and in the presence of all counsel and the defendant. And there was another quote in here that it should be actually the rare case where the defendant isn't present in such in-chambers proceeding. And in fact, that's been my experience in all the years I've practiced law in trials, is that if there's any issue that comes up with regarding a jury, I had one with before Judge Bastianelli not too long ago, and I remember we're going to have to go back and voir dire the jury on this or that issue. Always bring the defendant back. I mean, it would be almost unthinkable to not bring him back there.
Counsel, your time has elapsed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Another justice has a question, and I will ask you whether, on rebuttal, whether harmless error applies in this case, the doctrine of harmless error. Mr. Balestrieri, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Balestrieri.
Early in the argument, the court made reference to the Judicial Council's 1996 note to section 97104. And I would like to just briefly perhaps address that note and some of the other legislative and statutory history of this provision. Now, the Judicial Council note, which was written in 1996, says this statute defines the proceedings at which a criminal defendant has a right to be present. Okay? That's contrary to my argument. I will point out that this note was written in 1996, which is 25 years, more than 25 years after the statute was enacted. If you go back, there's some very interesting things in the session laws, believe it or not. There are actually some notes to this provision right in the session law that enacted the statute. And those notes in the session laws are very consistent with my argument that this statute does not create a right of a defendant to be present, but rather creates a procedural requirement that the defendant be present. The note says, this provision is new. By the way, this statute, this is an ancient statute. This has existed in one form or another since Wisconsin has been a state back in 1848. It's been revised over a dozen times. The latest, the revision that's relevant to our inquiry here today, the statute that exists in roughly its present form, was enacted in 1970 as part of the comprehensive revision of the entire Code of Criminal Procedure. Anyway, the comments, which are included in the session law, which is Laws of 1969, Chapter 255, Section 63, say, new. This is designed to clarify rules for attendance of defendant at various stages in the criminal proceeding. Now, that doesn't sound like the drafters of this statute had any intention to create a right. They had an intention to clarify rules for attendance. They thought they were creating a procedural rule, not a right.
What's the difference between a procedural requirement and a right?
The critical difference is in terms of waiver. If you've got a right, you can waive it. If you are under an obligation, you can't waive it. There is no right to waive an obligation. It's like saying I have a right to pay my income taxes, which I just did a couple of weeks ago. When I was doing my returns, did I think I had a right to pay my income taxes? No. I have an obligation. I have a requirement. I have to do it. And that's what this statute does.
I know it doesn't use the word right, but if the legislature enacts a procedural requirement, this procedure is required. Under the statute, you are required to be present.
That's what the statute says.
You are required to be present. I smile because I think of a phrase that Justice Babbage would use, and it would be this. He would say, well, that is a statutory due process. Then you've got a requirement. You can say it's a right, but if it's a procedural requirement, that awfully easily, to me, transposes into a right, but not for you, regardless of whether or not you pay your taxes, counsel.
I can meet you halfway here.
Okay. Well, that's a good start.
I can say that in terms of what it is easy for us as judges and lawyers who talk about rights, who talk about waiver all the time in numerous contexts, it is easy for us to conceptualize this when we're talking about a defendant's presence. It's easy for us to conceptualize it as a right. It's easy for us to conceptualize it as a waiver of that right. And in fact, in many, many cases, this court has talked about it as a right. In many, many briefs that I have written, in cases that you have decided, I have talked about it as a right. Because it's easy for us to talk about it that way. But this case requires us to be a little more precise. In some of the other cases that we've had, you know, it was fine to talk about it as a right. It was fine to talk about it as a waiver because it didn't matter whether it was a right or a requirement. In this case, it does. So we've got to be a little more precise. We've got to look at this statute and every one of its words and every one of its nuances in all of its legislative history to decide what does this statute do? Because it matters. It matters if this is a situation that creates a right, because then we may have a real problem with whether the defendant can waive it, whether the attorney can waive it. But if it doesn't create a right, if it creates an obligation, then there's no question about waiver.
Well, it says that, except as provided in 2 and 3, defendant shall be present at trial. Suppose the defendant is not present at trial.
At the beginning, you mean?
Pardon?
Do you mean if he's not present at the beginning?
Right. We've had a case where the guy just flew the coop, wasn't present, and we said the case would not proceed, right?
Yeah, under the statute, the case cannot proceed unless the defendant is there at the beginning.
So you view that as an obligation, but it's an enforced obligation, is that it?
It is enforced to the extent that the defendant has to be present at the beginning. It is not enforced once the defendant is present at the beginning, he can then leave. And then
well, that's because that's what sub 3 says.
That's sub 3.
But sub 1A says he's got to be present at trial unless there's an exception. So that's his obligation. You think that the court can say, well, it's your obligation. You're not there. We're going to hold it anyway.
I'm sorry. I didn't quite hear you.
Can you say that the court will hold trial even if he doesn't show up?
The court cannot hold a trial under the statute if the defendant never shows up.
Why not?
Because that's what the statute says.
But it's not his right to be there.
But it's not his right. It's the procedure that we have set up. The procedure says you don't hold a trial unless the defendant is there at the beginning. That's the procedural rule. It has nothing to do with the defendant's rights. That's the procedural rule.
And what about 97108 about how to take a plea? Is that procedural and an obligation of the defendant or the court, or is it a right of the defendant?
Everything that's set for all of those various proceedings in 97104, it's all procedural. It's a procedural obligation. You don't do this. You don't continue with this procedure unless the defendant is present. Now, as
so
far as sub-3 is concerned,
it's the competence of the court then. That's what you're telling us.
I would say, if you want to phrase it in those terms, yeah, I would say it's the competence of the court to proceed. The procedural rule that grants the court competence to conduct a proceeding says you don't conduct it unless the defendant is there.
And then 97108 about how to take a plea of guilty and no contest and what the court shall do. If the court doesn't do all of that, that's the obligation of the court. The court doesn't have competence to proceed. Is that your argument?
Well, no. My argument looks only at the presence of the defendant, not what happens after the defendant is present. Now, if we don't have an appropriate plea colloquy, that doesn't relate to the competence of the court to proceed. That's a question of trial court error, not competence.
Oh, well, the statute sort of reads that the court has to do it all, just like the court can't proceed unless the defendant is present. But we won't argue.
Well, there's a difference between proceeding and what you do after you're proceeding. Whether you can proceed or not is a question of competence.
We won't debate under 97108. We'll stay with 97104.
Okay.
That'll make you more
sub 3. The note that is in the session law with respect to sub 3 says This section, this subsection, is designed to prevent a defendant from stopping a trial which has commenced by absenting himself. Now, that doesn't sound to me like it's creating any kind of a right of the defendant to waive a right to be present. That sounds like the people who wrote this statute were, again, creating an obligation to be present. But what they are saying is, if the defendant does not comply with this obligation, we're not going to let him torpedo the trial by failing to comply with his obligation to be present. If he's not there, the trial keeps going.
I thought some of those cases talked in terms of if the defendant absents himself, that he's waived it. That's a voluntary, knowing, intelligent.
Okay, well, you have to distinguish. Now, most of the cases that we've had, you have to just talk about the constitutional right. You have to distinguish between there is a constitutional right to be present. No question about that.
At all, what's the phraseology? At all substantial?
All, anything, at any proceeding where something of substance takes place.
Substantial rights of the defendant are involved.
Yeah. There's no question that there's a constitutional right to be present. When you have a right, you have a right to waive that right. And then the waiver of constitutional rights, knowing voluntary intelligence, you have to have the colloquy and, you know, all of those things that go along with constitutional rights. So you have to make the distinction here between the defendant's constitutional right to be present at a proceeding and the statutory obligation to be present at a proceeding. They're two entirely different things. They're created differently. The substance of the rule is different, and the consequences of the defendant's absence and the circumstances in which the defendant can be absent are different depending on whether you're talking about the constitutional right or the statutory obligation.
So what was the exact language of the session laws that you're relying on of 1969?
I'm sorry?
What was the exact language in the session laws of 1969 that tells you this is a procedural rule?
The exact language is new. That's the first word, period.
Okay.
This is designed to clarify rules for attendance of defendant at various stages in criminal proceedings.
Okay.
That's the exact language. That's the quote.
What happens under your theory if the defendant does not show up for voir dire?
If he doesn't show up for the voir dire cannot proceed. He has to be present at the voir dire as a procedural requirement. Now, does this make sense? I think a lot of what the statute says is not terribly clear. And I think what you have to do is you have to understand how this statute came to be. You know, as I said before, this requirement of the defendant being present has existed since 1848 in one form or another. It's been changed over a dozen times. Immediately prior to 1970, when this statute went into effect, we had a statute that was kind of a microcosm of the present statute. It was a statute that basically combined 971.04 sub 2 and at least the first part of 974.03. It dealt, in a nutshell, it dealt strictly with trials. It dealt when the defendant was required to be present at a trial. You had one provision that dealt with misdemeanor trials. You had one provision that dealt with felony trials. What one of the big things that the 1970 revision did was to vastly expand that previous requirement and to make it applicable at all of these other proceedings in addition to the trial,
well,
including the voir dire.
Mr. Balistrieri, 1970s was an era where the United States Supreme Court, including in the 60s, had, depending on your view, increased the rights of the defendant or read those into the Constitution and made them applicable to the states.
I remember it well.
I knew you would, as do I. And therefore, you might say that the 1970 revisions incorporated into the statutes constitutional rights, namely that these are all proceedings which affect these substantial rights of the defendant. Arraignment, trial, voir dire, evidentiary hearing, a view, and when the jury returns its verdict, and the pronouncement of judgment and sentence, and any other proceeding when ordered by the court. Okay.
Well, you could say that, but I don't think you'd find any support for it. Certainly, you know, certainly not in anything the legislature said. In addition to which, since this statute creates an obligation, it's much tougher than the constitutional right. The constitutional right can be waived at any time. Defendant, to the extent the defendant has a right to be present at a preliminary hearing, he can waive his right to be present. He can't waive his right to be present under the statute. Defendant can waive his right to be present at a trial under the constitutional right. Here, he has to be present, at least at the beginning. To say that there's a parallel between the statute and the constitutional right to be present, I don't think jives.
You have to drag the defendant to a view by the jury?
Do we have to?
Drag him? The defendant can't waive that right?
It depends on which, again, are you talking about the constitutional right or the statutory obligation?
Statute.
Under the statute, there is no waiver.
Okay. He's got to be dragged. If there's any view by the jury, he's got to be dragged if he doesn't want to go voluntarily. That's your position?
Well, it depends. Again, it depends. If we're talking about a trial, we're talking about a trial here,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Okay. At a trial, the defendant can excuse himself. And I use that language because that's the language that's used in sub 2 in terms of the defendant's absence from a misdemeanor trial. It says the defendant can be excused from attendance,
which
I think is more accurate than the term waive. He can be excused. He doesn't waive it, but he can be excused. Now, if there is a jury view, you have to look at it in terms of the defendant voluntarily excusing himself. If the defendant voluntarily excuses himself from a jury view during the trial, the statute does not require his presence. He can excuse himself.
Counsel, what was the change in 1996? The Judicial Council note of 1996 refers to the defendant's right to be present. What was the change in...
I honestly don't know what the 1996 change was, but it didn't have anything to do with what we're really talking about.
And that's a Supreme Court, looks like a Supreme Court...
I think they changed the wording from to voir dire. I think that's what they did.
Changed it to voir dire from any
proceeding.
From the selection of the jury.
Yeah, right. But substantively, I don't think that was a real change for our purposes.
Trying to follow your argument, counsel. Did the defendant have an obligation to be in chambers when the jurors, the two jurors, were brought in there?
Under the statute, we're talking statutory obligation here. Yes. There is an...
What do you point to that says that?
Generally because the statute says that the defendant shall be present at the trial, which would include all parts of the trial, unless he voluntarily absents himself.
Would you point to B rather than C then? If you were arguing for his obligation to be present?
Yes, I think B, at trial, is the statutory provision that applies here, not the voir dire. As I said, you know, in terms of the history of this statute, the voir dire was not even covered, you know, for over 100 years. The voir dire was only included, was only tacked on in 1970, so that there's a clear intention of the legislature to make a distinction between the voir dire, which is the selection of the jury, and the trial, which happens after the jury is selected and sworn. I think that's absolutely clear that the statute considers these to be completely separate and distinct proceedings and is not concerned, as the due process constitutional right is, with the substance of what goes on. It's concerned only with the proceeding. The statute names certain proceedings. They're distinct, they're separate, and we don't care what goes on at those proceedings as far as the statute is concerned. We're only concerned with the proceeding itself, because this is a procedural statute. It's not a substantive statute. It doesn't create rights. It's not concerned with fundamental fairness or anything else. It's just concerned with how do we proceed? How does this criminal proceeding go from one point where their complaint is filed, we have initial appearance, to the point where the defendant is sentenced? That's what the statute is concerned about.
Well, does he have a constitutional right to be present when there's a possibility that a juror is going to be excused?
Yes, I think there is a constitutional right, unless, as in this case, the defendant cannot contribute very much, or if anything, which is true in this case, to the outcome of that proceeding. Now, the constitutional due process right to be present. Due process is a very fuzzy concept. It doesn't create anything absolute. You have to look at the circumstances. So what the constitutional right says is you've got a right to be present at any proceeding where your presence, the presence of the defendant, is going to make a significant difference or could make a significant difference in the result of that proceeding. If the defendant's presence would not contribute to the fairness of the proceeding, then this constitutional due process right does not exist.
Isn't that really a harmless error analysis as opposed
no.
to whether or not the right exists?
No, that's
which, no.
I'm saying, yeah, well, you know, you can say that the concept is pretty much the same, you know, when you're looking at it. A defendant doesn't have the right to be present if his absence would be harmless error. I mean, you could look at it that way. But from a legal perspective, you're not looking at it from the back, which is the harmless error argument. You're looking at it from the front, which is the due process argument. So in looking at it from the front, you say the defendant does not have a right to be present if his absence would be harmless.
When I get to harmless error, this brings me to a question that I asked opposing counsel. What was he advocating in this court? You have a section in your brief on ineffective assistance of counsel and that Alexander failed to prove his attorney was ineffective. And yet he says he's not raising that claim here.
Well, that's why he doesn't prove it, because he's not raising it. And what I say is that he's got an obligation to raise that. He can't rely on a harmless error analysis, because that doesn't apply here.
Well, counsel, you say that harmless error doesn't apply. I probably, if I sat long enough, I could think of a case where the defendant's presence at trial really is not going to be very helpful. Defendant's not going to be able to help about cross-examining witnesses. We could really try this without him.
I can think of a lot of cases where that would be true.
That may be a lot of cases where it's true. All right. I think that if the defendant, let's say they're absent and we don't have a statutory problem whether the court's competent to proceed. What I hear you saying is, well, if the defendant isn't there, it's not a harmless error test. It's that you look at it from the front end and say, do we really need him here? Is he going to make a substantial difference or make any difference? And if he's not going to make any difference, his constitutional right to be present is gone. Have I misstated your argument?
I don't think you've necessarily misstated it. You just haven't fully stated it.
Okay. That's a very kind and gentle way of saying I misstated it. So you can now fully state it.
Okay. As I point out right at the beginning of my brief, there is no provision in the Constitution that says a defendant has a right to be present anywhere. What we do, this is one of these constitutional rights that is derived by inference from other constitutional rights.
Try due process.
It's derived from two rights. One of them is due process. The other one is confrontation.
Okay.
Confrontation doesn't apply in this case because we are not dealing with testimony being presented by witnesses relating to the issue of guilt or innocence. But in your hypothetical, that is the right to be present at what we would consider the trial itself, where witnesses are present, where witnesses are testifying on the issue of guilt or innocence, then the confrontation aspect of the defendant's right to be present kicks in. Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily talk about due process. We don't talk about the due process right. We talk about a right to confrontation.
That, of course, is due process under the 14th Amendment.
Well, it's applied to the states under the 14th. But the right to confrontation, which is a separate and distinct basis for the defendant's right to be present at a trial, would apply under your hypothetical situation. So we would not...
All expert witnesses know nothing that... He's the right to confront his expert.
He has a right
but
to confront
whether
his presence is helpful or not. He's got a right to be there when the witnesses are testifying. It's only when you have a situation like this where you've got something taking place in chambers where witnesses are not testifying, that the confrontation aspect of the defendant's right to be present drops out, and you look solely at the due process right.
So what other than a juror in chambers does your theory apply to?
Oh, it applies to all kinds of issues that are... legal issues that are decided.
Non-substantive. Scheduling.
Scheduling or... admissibility of evidence, for example, where you have a conference outside the presence of the jury on whether evidence should be admitted, that happens all the time. I mean, you see that quite frequently. But anything dealing with legal issues where you don't have a witness on the stand, where you don't have a jury in the box, all of those issues, when we're talking about the constitutional right now, as opposed to the statutory requirement, Those types of conferences are all subject to the notion that the defendant has a constitutional right, due process right, to be present if his presence is necessary to a fair determination of whatever is discussed at that issue, at that proceeding. And the cases basically say that if it's nothing but legal issues that are decided, The defendant usually doesn't have to be present at those types of conferences.
Mr. Balestrieri, my understanding is that the defendant, through counsel, is critical of and claims error on the part of the trial court in excusing these two jurors. These two jurors, the court basically designated as alternates and got rid of as alternates, making some comments about cause. Is there error in that from your point of view?
If there is, it's not an issue that is cognizable in these proceedings. That has not been raised in the petition for review. The only thing that was raised is whether or not the defendant's presence violated any constitutional or statutory right. So it doesn't matter if the judge was right or wrong. in excusing these jurors. As I have phrased the question, first of all, defendant had no constitutional right to be present, so counsel could waive his presence. He had no statutory right to be present, so counsel could waive his presence as a matter of trial tactics. If counsel screwed up, if counsel made an error in waiving the defendant's presence as a matter of trial tactics, then that becomes a question of ineffective assistance of counsel. And the only issue of prejudice is whether, if counsel had not erred by waiving the defendant's presence, would the result of this proceeding have would the result of that proceeding have been different? Whether the result was right or wrong is really not an issue. It's just whether it would have been different.
I'll try to ask this once more. I'm not sure I understand your argument. The defendant, in your view, does not have a statutory right to be in chambers.
Well, that's true. He has no statutory right to be there.
And I asked you if there was a statutory obligation for him to be in chambers.
Yeah, and to the extent, if I didn't make myself clear, let me try to make myself more clear now. He has an obligation to be present at the trial. To the extent that what goes on in chambers is part of the trial, he has an obligation to be present.
Okay.
But again, as with any other part of the trial, he can voluntarily absent himself from that proceeding in chambers, as with any other part of the trial.
Okay. But he was not in chambers under your analysis. He was not in chambers. Counsel was in chambers. Counsel waived his right to be in chambers before counsel ever conferred with him.
That is absolutely
right. I understand it, he's sitting out.
He was apparently in the courtroom when this was going on, as far as I can tell, yeah.
Okay. If there's no knowledge that the defendant has an obligation to be in chambers, no recognition by the court and the attorneys that he has an obligation to be in chambers, and he isn't asked beforehand whether he waives the right to be in chambers, how do you prevail here?
Because it's not a question of waiver. That's the critical part of my argument. Since he has no right to be present, it's not a question of whether he waives his right to be present, because he has no right to be present. So it's not a question. There's no need for a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of a right to be present, because there is no such right. The statute just says that his absence has to be voluntary. And voluntary in the ordinary and usual interpretation of that word simply means not coerced. So, he wasn't asked. No question about that. He was never asked, do you want to be present? Would that have been a good idea? Yeah, it would have been a good idea. I'm not saying that what went on here was the optimal way of this, the way this should have been handled. But the thing is, when a defendant, this is a well-established rule, when a defendant voluntarily chooses to have counsel for his defense, he voluntarily cedes to counsel, gives to counsel the right to make tactical decisions. Whether the defendant is present at this in-chambers conference is a tactical decision. That's what I'm arguing. So what happens here is that it's voluntary, not in the immediate sense that the defendant says, yeah, I'm happy with with not being there. But it's voluntary in the sense that the defendant has voluntarily made the attorney his agent for making tactical determinations like whether he is present at one of these proceedings. And I would also point out, as long as you brought this up, there is nothing in the record that suggests that the defendant wanted to be present. I mean, we had a situation where counsel goes and talks to the defendant, says, look, this is what's going on in chambers. What do you have to say about it? There's no suggestion that the defendant ever said, oh, gosh, I'd like to be there. I want to be there in person.
But in your analysis, that doesn't make any difference. That's
in my analysis, it wouldn't make any difference.
Irrelevant.
But I just point out that relevant or not, and there's nothing in the post-conviction motion that says the defendant ever wanted to be present. So in terms of voluntariness, did he voluntarily absent himself? I think on this record we have to say, yeah, he did.
So that was your response to Justice Prosser on the statute. Your response to him on the constitutional right to be present is there's no right unless it's a critical stage and it would affect, and here it's not a critical stage.
That's correct.
Affect.
He had no constitutional right to be present. So, again, counsel saying, I don't want my client there because I don't want him shooting off his big mouth, tactical decision. And it may have, as far as we can tell, a pretty good tactical decision, because we don't know what this defendant would have said had he been present.
It may have been a good tactical decision, but I think the defendant got convicted. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel? Mr. Kessler?
Thank you. In the brief time that I have, just a couple of points that I'd like to make. First of all, the idea that this is just simply a procedural statute, the section 97401. There's plenty of statutes that court specifically to section 96810 and 96811 dealing with searches and seizures, which could be viewed as procedural statutes, but when they create these statutes, they're doing so in the shadow of procedural due process. I think that's clear. They write the statute, but their underlying concern is this is what the courts are saying, so let's codify what the courts are saying into a statute. And the two statutes that came to mind, at least as Mr. Balistrieri was speaking, was 96810 and 96811. I think that 97401 is very similar in that regard, in that the legislature apparently attempting to try to codify by way of statute substantive due process rights, constitutional rights. I think there is a parallel here between what the statutes are saying and what the constitutional rights are of a defendant, and I think that permeates itself pretty much throughout the statutes on criminal procedure, whether that be 97401 or 96810 and 11, all of these statutes are drafted in the shadow of what the courts are doing in determining our person's substantive constitutional rights. Let
me ask counsel, you didn't have this statute 97104 at all, just repealed. What would be your constitutional basis for the right the defendant to be in chambers?
Well, I think that the right to be present is at all important, where all important substantive steps are taken, is something that I think is very clear in the case law of this court in both Harris and Anderson. And I believe, and again, I apologize for maybe not academically not remembering, but I'm certain that these cases are based upon federal case law, federal decisions interpreting what the Constitution requires. So I think the very explicit rules that we have in Harris and Anderson are undoubtedly derived from federal case law, federal courts interpreting the federal Constitution, and undoubtedly it's based on United States Supreme Court case law. I know the state has referred to the state law saying that the Constitution, that it's a derived right, that it's not a right that's explicit in the Constitution. But certainly, I think the courts have interpreted the Constitution in such a way that that the defendant does have a substantive right to be present. Statement here, I know it's the brief. Essentially, they say neither the state nor the federal constitution specifically guarantees a criminal defendant a right to be present at trial. Rather, the right to be present is derived from the defendant's right to be heard, right to confront the witnesses against him, and right to due process. So I think the state is even conceding here that this is, it's a constitutional right. It may not say so explicitly in the Constitution, but at least through the interpretation of the courts, higher courts, including this court and Harris and Anderson, but and undoubtedly many federal cases before that, have determined that there is, in fact, a right, a substantive due process right to be present. So that's how I would respond to that. And I think that the Chief Justice kind of hit the nail right on the head, that if we accept the state's position in this case, and again, trying to draw a distinction between confrontation and an in-chambers proceeding involving jurors, say, well, if it's a confrontation issue, for example, he has the right to be present in court while witnesses are being examined. But ultimately, the question is, well, on appeal now, though, he's going to have to show that his absence somehow or another affected the proceeding. And I don't think that there'll ever be a case where the defendant will be able to come in and make that showing. And in fact, I think, as was recognized by one of the justices here today, frequently it would be easier if the defendant weren't there. First of all, there are quite a few defendants who just don't come off right, even when you just look at them. A lot of people say he's guilty right out of the box. Other times you'll be in trial and the defendant's tugging on your shirt collar and tugging on your sleeve and whispering in your ear while witnesses are testifying. And so it's actually would be easier in most cases to conduct cross-examinations without the defendant being there. And in fact, most cases probably would be the case that a cross-examination will be more effective without the defendant being present. So the defendant's almost never going to be able to show that had he been there, things would have gone better. Never be able to make that showing. So I think that's what it really boils down to, and I don't see that we can try to distinguish between, for example, the confrontation right. Well, he's got a constitutional right to confront his accusers, so when a witness is testifying, he has a right to be there. But he's not conducting the cross-examination anyway. It's his attorney that's doing that. The defendant is just sitting there as a potted plant. So I don't see any need to distinguish between, say, for example, oh, the defendant has a right to be there while witnesses are testifying, but he doesn't have a right to be there when you have this lengthy in-chambers proceeding where the judge essentially then ultimately kicks two jurors off the jury. I don't think that there's a reason to distinguish between those two things. So, again, I would just conclude by saying that I think if the state or if this court accepts the state's position today, I think the next case that's going to come along is where a defendant is just simply tried in absentia, and when the defendant appeals and says, I had a right to be present, the state will be arguing, well, and they'll be arguing based on State versus Alexander. They'll say, well, in State versus Alexander, you have to come in here and prove that your absence had some effect on the outcome, or that your absence was necessary, or that your presence was necessary, and that unless you can prove that, then it doesn't matter. And so that's why I would urge the court to accept the defendant's arguments and reverse the Court of Appeals and grant him a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. I want to, on behalf of the court, thank Mr. Kesser and Mr. Balistrieri on our court again hearing a case that involves the presence of the defendant at various stages, and it has come up with some frequency relating to the jury or conversations with the jurors. That ends our proceeding in 11AP 394 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Alexander. Before counsel are dismissed, I do want to welcome Salem High School students. Would they please stand? I have that there are 12 of you, so I don't want to have to do a body count of all the students. Are they now standing? Well, thank you for coming. You may now be seated. You sit more quickly than you stand, but we welcome you. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite students to come for an oral argument. If they come, they listen to the argument. They've been given materials about the case. They have engaged in some activities relating to the case. And then at noon, they will meet with a justice of this court who has been assigned to meet with the students. The discussion will be procedural. That is, how we accept cases, how we decide cases, and how we issue opinions. The discussion will not center on the substantive issues presented in the particular case. Anyone who wishes to come, they're cordially invited. It's not limited to the students. Counsel may come also. And today, the justice who will speak with the students is the justice to my right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The other justices on the bench are from on my right, Justice Annette Ziegler, Justice David Prosser, Justice Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, Justice Patrick Crooks, Justice Patience Robinsack, and Justice Michael Gableman. With that, we are in recess, and maybe these Salem High School students are going to stay. Maybe a new group from Salem High School is coming in. And we will start in a few moments. We are in recess.